Email's the best way to communicate with your friends, better than that antique telephone you have at home. And we made a song up about it, and this is how it goes. And this is Albert Herman. He's going to sing it with me.
Hi, nice to see you.
Email's a great way to stay in touch with one another. It's all right.
Jump online and write to a friend and stay in touch forever. It's online.
Email's like speaking telepathically through a machine.
Staying in touch is using email better than your best dream.
Email's a great way to stay in touch with one another. It's all right.
Email, email, email,
email,
email, email, email,
email,
email, yang bell, yang yang email, yang yang email, yang yang email. It's online.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a brand new episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I am here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony, Lieutenant in the Positivity Force Maddox.
You know, I'm always like, what did I do that was significant that this week that Andy's going to make a funny joke about? And I couldn't think of anything, so I'm glad you just came up with something totally different about your new favorite work of art.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just saying you're a positive guy.
Yeah, I'm just a positive guy.
It's like the military, but for being nice.
But for being nice. Of course, of course. Really, really glad that we're getting this started up finally.
I don't think there's any way to turn that into an intro. I'm going to be thinking about it, though. Trust me, I'll be thinking about it. And
dear
you
listener,
for listening to this.
I'm so sorry about the 5-minute intro that you just listened to, which actually, on that subject, before we get into anything serious, last week we recommended Bunta Vista, is that correct?
Yeah.
And I put it on last week and I was delighted to start listening to, I don't know, 10 or 20 minutes of the origin story of the Grunter part of the Bunta Vista sort of setting. And then it occurred to me that we had just recommended that people go listen to this podcast. So to everyone who did, I'm sorry, or I'm happy for you if you enjoyed that.
It's like, what's that law that says if anything bad can happen, it will happen?
Mm-hmm.
What's that one? It's got a name. It's called Murphy's Law.
Is that, I want to say Moore's Law, but that's the thing about...
No, it's not Moore's Law. It's not Sturgeon's Law.
Nope.
It's... Doesn't matter. Anyway, I feel like it should be another law of the universe, which is that if you recommend a podcast, that is the week they will do the cringiest episode. Because
yeah, and then they made fun of a 10-year-old boy for 20 minutes.
I've already listened to the bonus episode. Remind me of the 10-year-old boy they made fun of.
Oh, some nerd who wanted to petition to change the nerd emoji to genius.
Oh, yeah.
Emoji.
I mean, come on. That guy had it coming. That was not... I mean... Good for you for trying something, I guess. You don't want to discourage. Oh, you haven't seen these mats yet. Hold on.
I'm afraid you haven't seen these yet.
You got too much stuff on them. Wow.
I think this came out great. Right?
Yeah.
And also, look at this. This doesn't even look that bad. I feel like the fact that it's shiny makes this look way better in real life than it does in that picture.
Yeah.
You can't really tell that it's not perfect.
No.
In the details. But if you're listening, it is perfect in the details.
People,
it's as perfect as you'll ever need it to be.
People are going
to
be so into this.
I think they're going to like it too.
I feel like it needs...
I'm hoping they're going to
like
it.
A quarter inch more space.
No, I know. Did I not tell you the whole art got scaled up a little bit because they didn't tell me there was a bleed and they treated it as if
Bleeds
it had a bleed?
Are so confusing.
They're not confusing. It's so simple. Except if I give you artwork that doesn't go to the edge, and you know there's a bleed, and the artwork I gave you is exactly the dimensions of the finished product.
Let me rephrase. Bleeds make me anxious. I'm always worried I'm going to do it wrong.
Okay, now that actually does make sense, because it is a thing that you can't see, so did you do it right?
Did you do it right?
Who knows?
I don't know. And often things are not documented in a way that I feel confident in.
Anyway, if you're listening to this, you'll know if I was able to somehow make a Positivity Force intro, or maybe you just don't know what I'm talking about, and that's okay, too. It's fine. This is a normal podcast. This week on this very normal podcast, we're going to do a very normal podcast sort of thing, which is a mailbag episode, because I forgot I was traveling this weekend. We're recording a little bit last minute. Sorry for not planning better. But also, we've got questions that stack up that we don't often get to address directly on the show, and so now is a good time to do that.
I've been wanting to do a mailbag episode for forever, because it's fun.
Look, I would do more mailbag episodes if we got more questions, but frankly, looking at my inbox, we get a lot of more of a comment than a question kind of emails, which is fine. You can keep those coming. I read most of the email. I read the email, so I've got the gist of your comment, and then
okay.
I don't read
we
much
read
more.
We read every word lovingly, and sometimes...
I mean, you can do that if you want.
Don't respond. Sorry, it's a lot of emails. We get so many emails for like work and stuff, and then there's more emails, but we appreciate you.
Yeah, email has lost every bit of its appeal. I mean, I remember in our lifetimes, it was like amazing that you had email, and now it's just like... It is purely awful. That's what we did. Except, humanity. Good job, whatever. Humanity. Anyway, I would love to do more mailbag episodes if we got more questions, but we don't actually get that many questions, to be perfectly honest. For a lot of the ones we get, it's kind of like we have a whole episode dedicated to this. We could record and talk about it again, which is some merit to doing because we're growing and changing people. You know, the podcast topic of Theseus. No, the other one. Man in the River. Never the same man, never the same river. What's the... I don't remember the name of the philosopher. Heraclitus. We're that guy, though. We're that guy with for podcast topics. So there's merit to revisiting them sometimes, but a lot of times I feel like we'd just be saying the same things over again, and then it's not worth doing, and so I'll just point people to old episodes. So if you have questions we haven't touched on, you should send them in. Or, you know, we get a lot of questions where it's like, I do want to talk about this, but either, A, I feel totally unqualified to.
Yes,
like, we get questions
definitely.
About designing custom cards or cube pretty often, and I'm like, you could do that. I never have. I don't know what to tell you. You know, like, I don't think we're the people to discuss that. Maybe we'll find a good guest sometime to discuss custom cards and cube or something like that. But that's the other category of question, like, thing that we haven't talked about for a good reason. So if you think you're listening, you can thread that needle between topics that we've already talked about on previous episodes, topics that we haven't talked about intentionally, and actually writing a question instead of mostly a comment, then send it in, mail@luckypaper.co. You can send whatever you want in, to be clear. I'm just, you know, that's what we really want, is that particular kind of question.
Or if you know somebody that would be a fantastic guest that you could connect us with, that's always cool.
Yeah, I'm always down for that. Connect us with a good guest. Anyway, we have some questions here, both from our mail inbox, and also we poked the MTG Cube Talk Discord for some questions as well. So we have a couple of shorter ones here from our homies over there. Where do you want to start?
Why don't we start at the beginning of our document, which is very arbitrarily ordered. Where do you want to start?
No, I agree. I think his first one's good. Let me read it, because we kind of got this question in two different forms. The first question comes from YOLO Swag Boy in our email inbox from God knows how long ago. The email reads, I've had drafts of people's cubes where it felt like every pick had high stakes to it, and this persisted throughout the draft. While I get this occasionally in my own cube, there are often times where it feels like, oh, obviously this is what I'm supposed to take here. I guess my question would be, how can a cube designer ensure they are seeding an interesting and fun drafting experience, focusing primarily on the drafting portion of the game? This kind of dovetails a little bit nicely with a question we got from Couch Life on the Discord, which is, I wish for the Lucky Paper radio host to design their perfect booster pack. I want to know what you would hand to someone and be like, oh, this booster pack is Andy/Anthony. I think these are similar questions. Like, how do you make sure that you're designing for an interesting draft? And also, what's your ideal booster pack to open?
I feel like they're a little bit different. Did you also say...
You want to start by being pedantic and yeah. arguing that I shouldn't have grouped mm-hmm. these questions together? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's only appropriate
did
for
you
this
say,
show.
Did you say credit to YOLO Swag Boy?
I did, at the
okay,
very beginning.
Great. I think these questions are actually a little bit different. I think the question about keeping the draft fun and dynamic is something that we sort of touch on a little bit in a lot of episodes. And to me, the most obvious thing is just making sure that all the cards are relevant and the cards are relevant in different ways depending on how you draft them. So if you have some things that are just generically pretty powerful cards, but other things that are cards with really high ceilings but don't necessarily go in every deck, that just means there is a lot more potential in ways you can navigate from a pack one, pick one, and you can say, well, do I want to start with something that's really just solid and is going to work, or do I want to take something that's a little bit riskier? And those kinds of packs will give you that feeling of not just having like an obvious this is the best pick, I'm going to take it. Similarly, not having huge power outliers, so it's not just like literal power or a very low power cube that has lightning bolt where it's just objectively right to take the same thing. The question about what is my ideal pack probably isn't that, because I just want to see Earl of Squirrel there in the corner and be like, yep, I'm going to see you in 8 picks. good seeing you, buddy. And it's not necessarily about, I mean, maybe that's my flaw. Should I be opening a pack and thinking, yes, this is the like highest strategic density, most difficult pack?
So I think you could take Couch Life's question, you could interpret it a couple ways. Like, what is my ideal pack as a drafter? Well, mm-hmm. I want two excellent cards for my deck and for one of them to be wheelable, right? Like, that's my ideal pack as a drafter or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My ideal pack as a, like, designer, like, what pack do I think speaks most to my cube design sensibilities is, like, a pack that has nothing but fixing lands and one and two drops in it and is a relatively even power level. I also think there's some room for interpretation here with YOLO Swagboy's question, because as I read this, I think YOLO Swagboy is implying that having high stakes for every pick is better. That is, like, that's what he means by ensuring that the draft stays interesting. But I'm not sure if that always holds true, especially for different levels of investment among different players. If every pick is like a, well, this could go either way kind of situation, a lot of players will just kind of get a little paralyzed and be like, well, okay, I don't know what to take here. I feel like there's too many options and they're all great and I'm kind of like stuck. Or honestly, you can go so far in that direction that it kind of actually doesn't matter what you take. Like, I've drafted some cubes that are obscenely narrow power level, and it's like, okay, well, I could take any of these. They're all defensible.
Any of these 8 2-for-1s in this pauper cube is a reasonable way to go.
Right, exactly, where it's like, people always talk about the virtues of a narrow power level band, and that's always, you know, relative to retail limited. But within a cube, if everything is too close to the same power level, then the draft loses a lot of its meaning. It's like, all right, find a lane, stay in it, and your deck will be functional. So I don't know that there's like one specific way to make the draft more interesting. I think it's a question, YOLO Swagboy, for you to determine what constitutes an interesting draft. And this question's from a while ago, but ironically, we touched on this quite a bit, I think, last week on the show, where we were talking about the differences in the regular cube, which maybe prioritizes gameplay above like novel, interesting draft experience. It's not to say it's not fun to draft, but I think if there's like a scale, you're tipped towards, let's make sure these games resemble the kind of limited games I love to play. And contrasting that with Ryan Sachs' build-around cube, which definitely, I think, tips the scale the other way in favor of a really interesting draft, where, like, every time you sit down, there's endless possibilities in front of you, and every pick could, like, totally change your direction of your deck, you know, on a dime. And you got to decide where on that spectrum is valuable for you to be, right? Like, all that being said, I probably would still enjoy drafting the regular cube more, because that's just more in line with the kind of magic I enjoy. Back-to-back drafts of the regular cube are going to be more similar, right? Like, you're not going to get a ton of range draft-to-draft, but you still have all the things that are inherently fun about drafting. I think YOLO Swagboy here is asking about how do you capture that sort of Ryan Sachs build-around cube-esque, every pick is, like, critically important and can take your draft in totally different directions. And I think you touched on a lot of those ideas. One thing is, yeah, make sure you have a bunch of wild build-arounds that have a really high ceiling but a really low floor, which means that your players are often presented with the question of, am I willing to commit to this and try and make it work to get the payoff, or do I just take a much less powerful, safer pick, right? The question of, oh, this is obviously the right pick, always comes up when the best card is also a safe card, where it's like the card that is the most powerful, that has the highest ceiling in this pack, is also just always going to be good, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at the build-around cube, or another good example of this is Caleb Gannon's Synergy Cube. You know, I think Caleb's approach to that cube is really great, and he articulated something in a very obvious way, which I had never like heard articulated so clearly before, which is that he just didn't want you to be able to win the game without doing something highly synergistic. Omit cards from the cube that have the ability to just win the game without you having to do something around them. And this is very similar, I think, to like some of the ways that power is metered in Old Board of Magic and like the neoclassical cube. Like, power outliers back in the day were things like Fast Bond and Ancestral Recall and Mind Twist and, you know, whatever. But none of those cards kill your opponent, right? Whereas powerful cards today are like Uro and Oko and Minskinboo, and it's like, you can just play that and do nothing else and maybe win the game. And so thinking about where you put your power level, do you put it into these things that require you commit to it versus not, is another great way to tip the scales further in that direction. And I don't know what your cube looks like, Swagboy, but it's entirely possible that what this will require, if you really are committed to this, is cutting a lot of cards you otherwise think of as being like central to what your cube is, like cutting the Lightning Bolts, cutting the Swords to Plowshares. I mean, those aren't even great examples because those are also answers, but it means cutting the Fable of the Mirror Breaker, or cutting the Worm Coil Engine, or cutting like the Titans, like these cards that just do a whole bunch on their own and can like solo a game pretty much, that are also relatively safe. I mean, the Titans are expensive, so depending on the environment, that's not a safe pick at all, but I think that's the main axis you should be looking at here, assuming that the tone I'm reading in this email is correct, that you think having every pick being interesting is ideal. I actually don't think my ideal draft has every pick being super interesting. I think some of the draft should be really interesting picks, and some of the draft should be getting rewarded for actually having drafted properly. And like, yeah, I wield this card, is really good for my deck. It's a slam dunk. It's easy. And I want that to happen, right?
Yeah. I'm just thinking about sort of the best emotional experience of going through a draft, and it does potentially, it starts with pack one, pick one is this really difficult choice of how do I want to navigate this? And pack two, pick one is just windmill slam. This is exactly what I need for my deck. And now I'm super confident going into the second half of the draft.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily like maximum decision, but it feels great.
Well, another way to like put this is I really like high decision games with a lot of decision points where your decisions really matter. Like that agency is something I'm seeking in especially the design of the Bun Magic Cube. But that does not just mean more decisions, right? I don't want you to have to make a bunch of tiny little decisions all the time and have everything matter critically. I want there to be parts of the game where you just get rewarded for having made a proper sequencing decision, right? For having drafted your deck well and been able to, you know, play your snowballing threat and protect it for a turn and also have a removal spell for their blocker. Like, then I want it to be easy, right? Like, I want there to be portions of... I want the decision density to be heterogeneous, like spread throughout both the draft and the gameplay, where there are critically important moments you can afford to spend a bunch of time tanking about, both in the draft and in the gameplay, and there are turns that are rote because you're way ahead because you drafted the right kind of deck, or the turn is rote because you're just trying to find your board wipe, and that's what your deck is designed to do. You make every decision to try and find that board wipe, but there's not, like, a branch, necessarily. There's not another direction you could be going. So that's what I think about this question. I think, ultimately, it's like... figure out what you mean by focusing on the draft experience. What is actually your goal? If your goal is having more branching decisions, even late in the draft, then I think you should be looking at Caleb's Cube and Ryan's Cube and cubes like that that have a ton of build-arounds, a ton of complexity mechanically that allow for wild fluctuations in card evaluations based on context.
Yeah, and I think you're right. This might have to do as much with what's not included as much as what is included. So I think you could also just arrive at this place of very high sort of complex decisions just by iteratively cutting the things that people take most highly.
Yeah, I mean, you could just take some notes. The next time you see a card in a pack that you're like, well, this is obviously the pick.
Yeah.
Cut it. Do that for a month. See how it looks. That's going to be hard. People don't like doing that. But
people don't like doing that, but also it's not like a commitment. You could do that for a couple months, see where the cube is, and have those cards set aside in a pile, and you can always put them back.
This happens all the time to me where I'll like make a cut on Cube Cobra, and I'll get comments like, I can't believe you're cutting this. And it's like, why? There's literally no stakes. If I decided I was wrong
the
2 weeks from now, I'll just put it back.
Could not be lower.
Yeah. I mean, being like a podcast person, I have a little more stakes than most in that people are looking at it and like thinking about what I'm thinking. But I make cuts... very freely. I just bloop, 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 get him out of here. Always bring him back. Couch Life, to your question. Again, if I'm a designer, I love packs that have a ton of fixing, a ton of cheap cards, and I do like a pack that has a potential high ceiling build around.
Definitely.
And I'm talking about relative, right? Like a high ceiling build around in like your cube, like Traxos or something, is more committal than I'm excited to pick most of the time. But a card like Dark Confidant, okay, mm-hmm. That's a card that it's generically powerful, but also it does push your deck in a certain direction. You can't just put Dark Confidant in any black deck and have it work. And so that's the kind of card where it's like, all right, I want ways to protect this. I want a low curve. I want removal spells to like, you know, draw the game out so my card advantage matters more. Like cards like that are the ones that I'm really excited to pick, or like your Snapcaster Mage, where it's like, now this is better with more spells. Or maybe one of my favorite cards to pick early is still Dreadhorde Arcanist. I know I say it all the time on this show, but just the way that you can draft that card early and then make your whole deck about doing something I already want to be doing anyway, which is casting a bunch of cheap spells, but also getting to make this card really good. That's what I really like to see as a designer in a pack. And yeah, as a player, I just want my packs to be better than all my opponent's packs and to get the cards I want for my deck all the time.
Perfect.
I kind of think Couch wanted us to like list 15 specific cards.
I cannot do that right now.
I can't do it either. Sorry, Couch. We'll talk about it on the Discord. All right, next up we have a question here from listener Brandon to the email address. I'm going to paraphrase this a little bit. Brandon says, I would love to hear an episode devoted to discussing the differences and cogent similarities of cube design in old frame / old magic cubes. There's more detail here. Sorry for not reading it all, Brandon, but, you know, time is money, as it were. This is something I've been thinking about a lot with the neoclassical cube, and I think I might have said on the show that I made an effort to, at KubeCon this year, play as many old border cubes as I could. I didn't get to play as many as I wanted because I didn't have as many main event draft slots as other people, given that I was doing commentary. But again, last year at KubeCon, I was so struck by how different the Old Border Foil Cube felt from Modern Magic. And ultimately, I think those differences have boiled down to a couple of, like, more apparent things, right? Like, old cards just, they weren't as powerful, so that's one thing. And to be clear, like, what that means is basically, like, the constants of Magic, starting with seven cards in your hand, playing one land a turn, starting with 20 life, these things that are not affected at all by the cards themselves, by, like, power level creep, those things feel different in old formats, right? 20 life feels like a bigger buffer, one land a turn feels slower, you know, everything just feels different when the actual things you're spending the mana on are recontextualized, which is important because we say all the time, and it's true, every cube is relative, right? Like, the most powerful card in the cube is still the most powerful card in the cube, no matter how powerful it is. What struck me about the old school Magic was that there are constants to the game that do not change with context. They're not relative. Those things I mentioned, those constants of the rules, and those things just felt different in the context of old Border Magic. There's also way less tokens, there's way fewer words on cards, there's no DFCs, all of these sort of obvious things that I think we all can easily recognize about old Border environment.
And I think another huge difference that you hinted at earlier is just that a lot of the cards, they were more willing to make cards that just did stone nothing if you didn't build around them. Whereas I think a lot of the cards they designed today, it's like, well, you get your first Drake token for free on your kicker card, and then you make more Drakes when you kick things in the future. A lot of old cards are just, here's an enchantment. If you don't do the thing it instructs you to do, if you're not playing along with this minigame, it does nothing.
Or they just kill you. Some of the cards just kill you if you don't do the right thing with them.
Which, I don't know. I think that is a very notable difference. I don't know if it's all downside, but it's something that you definitely have to be aware of if you're talking about cube design, because you can't necessarily have the same constructed style decks that were the way that Magic was mostly played when those cards were designed. You can't just say, yep, I'm going all in on enchantments and making Opalescence work. You have to draft that Opalescence and hope you get enough enchantments that make it do something and make sure that's like a reasonable payoff in your environment. So I think maybe the biggest thing is just the volume of cards. I know in your neoclassical cube, it's not necessarily that Ash Barons is this totally weird new thing that enables something and is like completely discontinuous with old Border Magic, but it just allows you to have a density of effects by breaking Singleton on it to make things like Astral Slide and Lightning Rift, things like that, just work in old Border in an environment that is drafted, which you just don't necessarily have as many cards to make as many things work at the same time in old Border.
Yeah, this is definitely the most salient difference, I think, that I have come to understand, because I do put some new cards in my old school cube. It's not strictly limited to only old Border cards. And I've had a really interesting conversation with myself and, like, journey in trying to figure out what new cards are actually relevant, right? And for a while, it was a gut feeling thing. It was like, okay, well, does this feel old school to me? Or, like, could this literally have been printed in old school Magic? Like, Burst Lightning could have been printed in an old school set with Kicker. Like, Kicker existed in old Border Magic. It just didn't happen to be, right? And that, you could argue, is a power level thing, and it is to some degree. But that card, otherwise, is like, it feels perfectly old school to me. It doesn't do anything that was not plausible in old school Magic. Whereas a lot of the, like, contemporary threats and things we talked about, like, just don't feel right because they do feel like they bring a lot of new Magic baggage with them. And for a long time, it was just a gut thing, just whatever feels old school to me. And I really started to identify that really what it comes down to is that I think for the most part, when you look at the early days of Magic, what people identify as old school, you know, pre-modern, basically, the enablers were broken. The enablers were extraordinarily powerful. Right. They're still the best enablers in Vintage and Legacy for the most part, right? The enablers were really, really, really strong. And the payoffs were not. The payoffs were like dinky things, right? All the best reanimation spells in existence, your Entombs, your Reanimates, your Animate Dead, that is all old school. You're buried alive. All old school. The best reanimation threat you get, like a Chroma, maybe Verdant Force, right? A card that was later.
Oh, yeah.
A card that was later.
Now you're speaking my language.
Yeah. I mean, that is still the reanimation threat of choice, I believe, in pre-modern. I try and follow that meta semi-closely, and I see reanimator decks with Verdant Force as the primary target all the time. So the, like, dynamic of powerful enablers and weak payoffs, I think, is the thing that I eventually landed on for that cube. So one of the new cards I run that has the biggest impact on the gameplay, but I still feel like is appropriate, is Bolas of Citadel, which is a card that I love, but feels very old school to me, right? It's Future Sight stapled to Channel, kind of, you know, two old school enablers, not payoffs. And it is also just fundamentally an enabler. All it does is let you cast more cards off the top of your deck very quickly.
It also does deal 10 damage to your opponent.
Yeah, that's not really the reason you put it in your deck, though. And
that's the reason you play. You specifically often play. I often just forget about that line altogether.
You do have to remember it. It's very important. Anyway, it is fundamentally an enabler. So, like, that is how I've come to identify what old school Magic means to me is powerful enablers, weaker payoffs. And a lot of that comes with also just, I think, a lot of the power being not on board. You know, like, a lot of the power was in your hand or on the stack and not in the form of creatures or permanents. You know, with a few exceptions, like your Survival of the Fittest or whatever, most of these cards we're talking about are instants or sorceries that just did something kind of messed up, or they had, like, a one-time impact on the game that was really powerful.
Sure, I mean, maybe this is a more literal way to express that difference in a lot of cards couldn't win the game on their own, is so much of the powerful cards they print today are just an effect staple to a creature, which literally every creature comes with a way to
win the game, yeah.
Whereas Survival of the Fittest cannot.
Yeah. So that's a big difference for me, and I think there is a ton of space to be played with inside of old border still. You know, every old border cube I've drafted has felt different, even though it has a wildly smaller card pool than modern cubes with all of Magic's history to draw from. And I'm still at a place where I'm exploring with the neoclassical cube. I'm very happy with some things. There are other things I'm not at all happy with. Eventually, I do want to write a big primer for it the same way I did for the Degenerate Micro Cube, outlaying how the cube is designed and why it's designed that way. But I don't feel like I've hit, like, a stasis yet. And obviously, a cube is never done. It will continue to be improved and modified. But I feel like getting to a point where I'm reasonably happy with all of the foundations is when I'll try and write that article. And it will be largely about everything I just mentioned and why I think that kind of gameplay is valuable and substantially different than modern Magic. All right, Anthony, here's a simple one that comes from our friend Deinonychus. What factor or factors make you excited or unexcited to draft a new cube?
So, I think a big one
doesn't
for
have
me...
Rule of Squirrel in it.
Yep. What's your answer? So, I'm a really just a big fan of, like, limited style gameplay and sort of relatively low power and legible cards that I've seen before. So, honestly, that's not the most exciting or splashy answer. But if I see a cube and I look at the list, I'm like, oh yeah, I know a bunch of these cards. I kind of have an expectation for how this format is played. That really does get me excited. Another thing is if I just see sort of interesting, unique power outliers that I'm like, okay, I think that this might actually be a really unique build around that I haven't necessarily seen shine before, because they've just been printing so many cards. There's all kinds of, you know, this was a rare in a format that we drafted a couple years ago, but it wasn't a powerful enough rare that it really was relevant and constructed. So it's not really a known thing, even though it's been around for a while. And when I see a cube that has a couple of those that stand out and I think, This might be an opportunity for me to see this card do something different. That really gets me excited.
Yeah, I'm definitely in a place where I care more about the texture of the games I'm playing than I do about the interest of the draft, to put this in the context of previous questions we've answered already. So as brilliant as I think Ryan's cube and Caleb's cube are, those are not near the top of the list of the cubes I'm particularly excited or unexcited to draft.
Yeah, I mean, speaking for myself, I'm excited to hear them talk about it, but I'm also a little bit intimidated by sitting down to draft one of those cubes, so my primary feeling isn't, hell yes, let's crack this pack.
Yeah, for me, I don't know if it's intimidation, it's more that, like, I would accept that if I was sitting down to draft one of those cubes, it would largely be an exercise in, like, experimenting with something new.
Yeah.
Like, let me try this new thing, and frankly, my relationship to the game right now is not one where I'm down to play, you know, 9 games of a deck that's just like a shot in the dark if it ends up being not fun, you know? And I consider a draft, like, if I commit to a draft, I'm going to see it through to the end. I'm not leaving somebody with a bye. So that's a main consideration for me. I also realized when we looked at the CubeCon list and I was trying to decide which cubes I wanted to draft that for me, there are two, like, very obvious things just from looking at the list that really do decide how much I personally want to play a cube, and that is the curve and the density of fixing.
Yeah.
Like, if you've got 30 fixing lands in your 360 card cube, like, I immediately am just like, I don't think I'm going to have fun with that. Like, well, I mean, first of all, just materially, I know from looking at the list, like, I'm going to have mana problems more than normal. Like, I'm just going to not be able to cast my spells sometimes. So are my opponents, right? There's just going to be some number of games that are just not Magic games, so that's a bummer. And it also speaks, I think, to the goals of the cube designer in a way that I immediately am like, I don't think we're on the same page about the kind of Magic we want to play if there's, you know, 3 or 4 cycles of lands in this 360 card cube. And the other one is curve, a cube that's got, you know, 4 or 5 cards above 5 or 6 mana in every color. I'm also just like, either these cards are not good or these are going to be games I'm not going to enjoy because we're getting to the point where everyone's casting 5 and 6 drops and that's just not the kind of Magic I'm interested in right now.
Sure. Yeah, I guess if I were to sort of abstract my point a little bit, and I don't know how to put this into some, like, firm description, but really it's just about the right amount of familiarity and the right amount of novelty. Do I feel like I'm going to sit down and be comfortable with drafting this and also do something new and exciting is really just what I think is going to get anybody excited about cracking a new pack.
Yeah. I don't mind if I'm unfamiliar with it. Like, I do like the idea of exploring something new. I mean, I drafted someone in our playgroups. They call it the Naked Cube. No tokens, no counters, no DFCs. The only game pieces you need are the cards themselves, cube, which was totally new for me. I never did anything like that before. That was fine. Like, I'm in to do something new, as long as it doesn't fit
the description.
But there's
still a lot of familiarity in there. Like, I'm sure you knew a lot of the cards, or at least...
I mean, I know a lot cards of that... all the cards at this point. It's pretty bad. Like, if we look at the list of all the cards and all the cubes at KubeCon, if you were to, like, take out just the cards in, like, the boat cube... And I actually do know most
of
the cards
in the boats. Yeah,
I actually do know most of the cards in the Reading Rainbow cube. It's the other one I was going to say. Like, that's a cube otherwise full of cards that I'm sure were like unique to lists at KubeCon. Like, I know a lot of the cards, which I'm not worried about playing a cube with cards I don't recognize. That doesn't give me pause at all. I do like the thing you said of like seeing a premier high mana value like card that I have not had a chance to play with before. Where it's like, oh, that's good here. Like. Oh, I'm looking at this cube list and you got Phyrexian Obliterator. Like, can I do that? Like, I want to see what that's like.
Oh, yeah.
That's exciting. All right, we got one here from Alex Snowtorch, who I just picked up a delicious chocolate sourdough loaf from. Shout outs to Alex Snowtorch. Alex wants to know a card that we both think could or should be in every cube, if one could exist, and or a card you just wish you could draft or see in every draft. Go ahead, give the mealy mouth. There's no one card that should be in every cube.
I don't know what I'm doing on this podcast. You can just do both. You can do both.
No, go ahead. I can see you winding up for it.
Yeah, no, I reject this question.
Say more. Reject it verbosely.
Well, of course we don't want one card that fits into every... Okay, how about this? Chromatic Star.
Sure, that could be your answer.
That's my one. Chromatic Star. I was wrong. I want Chromatic Star in every cube.
Speak on that a little more, though. Like...
I mean, it's just sort of this little trinket artifact that just does enough. You know, the floor is pretty high in that it just cycles and lets you fix your mana a little bit. Sometimes you will play it
for only
just
two
because
mana.
You need to fix your mana a little bit. But because it has so many little interactions between stuff that cares about artifacts, stuff that cares about drawing cards, and it has this one little wrinkle of you can actually sacrifice it some other way and you still get the card for it, which... That's just fun when that comes up a little bit. So, sure, that's a low-impact card that I feel like you can slide into pretty much any context, and it'll be fine.
There you go. No mealy-mouthed answer from Anthony. Planting his flag firmly in the Chromatic Star dirt. My gut just said Remand when I saw this question. I have put Remand in every one of my cubes. Actually, I guess it's not the Degenerate Micro cube, but it was at some point. I did try it out there for a little bit, and I can honestly maybe see a comeback. But that's a card I just love and scales with the power level of the environment. I would also put... the really clean cantrips that provide card selection here. Like, I am never upset to see Ponder or Preordain in any cube, and it's hard to imagine me designing a cube, again, like really extreme stuff like the Genet Micro Cube Accepted, where I just don't want to put those cards in it because it just takes whatever your cube is doing and it lets your players do that more consistently and more often, which, you know, whatever your goals are, they just get to do that more, which I think is great. And also, they're like iconic, powerful cards, right? Like legacy and vintage playable cards that are totally fine, I think, in the absolute lowest power level environments.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are certain types of cards that just scale really well, which make them actually suitable for a variety of cubes and other things that don't scale so well.
Yeah, I mean, Chromatic Star is a good example. That's in the Bun Magic cube. It's quite powerful there. It's also in your regular cube, and it's fine.
It's fine.
Yeah, it's regular. This question comes to us from the Spice-like Empress, a.k.a. Spice Torch. Tell us some thoughts about lands that don't get mentioned so often. We know a lot about Triomes, which we go on all a bunch about, and Shock Lands and DFCs, but what about all the other cycles of fixing lands or lands in general? While you're doing some scryfalling to inform your answers, I'll speak on a couple of cycles here. So, cycle of lands that I loathe, filter lands. I think they are awful to play with and just a huge nightmare to remember to tap your mana properly. This is a kind of an example of like the... focus on fun decisions, not more decisions. Like, having filter lands really makes you think about how you tap your mana, but that's not a fun decision to make. That's just a, hey, you got to think about this and not screw up. And I think that's a huge bummer. So I don't like filter lands. I'll contrast that with a cycle I do really like, which is pain lands. If I wasn't on double fetches, triple shocks, then pain lands would be high up there on my list of fixing lands because I love making your life total matter, and I love the game progressing towards an end. It's a lot of the reasons I like Fetchers and Chocks, and Painlands give you a lot of the same things, while also coming in untapped and letting you prioritize sequencing or prioritize preserving your life total, whatever is most relevant for the moment.
I've actually been playing with a Filterland in a Rotisserie draft deck, and I don't hate it that much. I feel like it's been pretty easy to manage, and it actually potentially, especially if you're interested in specifically enabling like two-color drafting, they do something so unique that I tolerate them a little bit.
You can defend them, but you only have one in your deck.
Is that really going to change the texture of your draft
to be like, oh, I have this one land, I can take double pip spells more highly.
But I think actually what's interesting about that is when they become really difficult to play with is if you're trying to play three colors or things like that, and you definitely need to be very careful about the way that you're tapping your lands, which we could think of as an upside, like it is a drawback as a player, but as a designer, if you're specifically trying to get people to play monocolor with a splash or like focus two color decks, they definitely push you in that direction just by the frustration they can generate and difficulty they can generate. So I think we could see that as an upside from a design perspective as well. I feel like we could sort of, just looking broadly at lands, kind of carve them out into two chunks plus maybe a couple of
the good ones and the bad
chunks.
Ones.
No, not that. I think it is lands that are attempting to be fixing lands that are not quite as good as dual lands. So we just have so many of these like minor drawbacks. So there's
sure.
the show lands,
check
fast lands, slow lands, all these kinds of things. I mean, filter lands, honestly, I would put in that same category as well. And all these sort of restrictions feel pretty arbitrary to me. You know, the difference between, oh, I have to have a swamp in play, or I have to have a swamp in my hand, or
I have to have two basic lands, or no more than two other lands.
I have to have at least two opponents.
Don't get me started on that one.
An interesting design space or interesting play space. A lot of these end up getting played because cube designers want to keep their cubes singletons. They're just like, yeah, let me get the 3, 4, 5 most efficient lands in each color pair. So these get played. To me, I don't think that those are really interesting or meaningful decisions most of the time. So I'd almost rather just say play a bunch of shock lands.
And that's what I've done.
Great. The other chunk of lands is lands that just do more stuff. You know, creature lands, horizon lands that are giving you some other downside to still make them worse in some strict sense than a dual land, because that's kind of the ceiling that they're pushing up against.
But they're trying to be something else too.
But they're trying to be something
just
else.
Just trying
yeah.
to be the best dual land they can print reasonably.
Right. So it comes into play tapped, giving you a little bit of mana cost. It has a life cost. It has some other thing. But later in the game, you animate it and turn into a creature. Later in the game, you get to scry a little bit. And here's where I'd love to see a little bit more, not just design innovation, but maybe more range of power levels, because we have things like the campuses that have scry for, what is it, 4 mana?
Yeah.
Things like that. And there isn't a lot in between where it's like, this isn't necessarily a competitive play. You're going to see this as a staple in all Eternal formats because it just costs, you know, I'm saying there's space in between where
there's
they
a ton
that
in between. There's almost none that are actually playable in Eternal formats. It's like Caracas.
And that I would even put in a separate category.
Because it's not fixing
like
at all.
This is a utility land, which, I mean, similarly, though, I think you're right. There is a lot more
okay,
space
then it's just
for
like Triome. I mean, Triomes, yeah.
Triomes are,
I don't even know.
Also do something
I'm trying to think of
specific.
Any fixing lands with upside. I mean, the Horizon lands are sometimes
Colonnade
playable.
Colonnade and Horizon lands.
Celestial Colonnade, I don't think has been played and constructed in a very long time.
That's probably true.
Maybe some, like, fringe blue-white modern. I'm sure we're going to get a note. Did you see the note we got about the fact that there apparently was, very briefly, in some esoteric, arena-only, rarity-restricted format, a deck that cared about playing Oketra's Monument combo?
Nice. So I sort of vaguely remember that from somewhere.
I don't think you were talking about what this listener was writing in about, because I had never heard of it before.
It's possible not. So yeah, I mean, that's sort of my thoughts on lands, is there's like good lands with the drawbacks that aren't very interesting. There are some other utility-fixing lands that are powerful. I mean, it's basically like a couple of creature lands. And then there's all these other things that are cool, and I put them in my cubes a lot, and sometimes people complain about them. So I'd love to see that space expanded a little bit more.
I think the tension in your cube is that some color pairs do get a shock, and the reality of all of these other fixing lands that do other things and why they don't see playing constructed is that they are ultimately so much worse than a shock land.
Yeah.
And so I don't think people are complaining that, you know, they have a Stirring Wildwood, they're complaining that they have a Stirring Wildwood and their opponent
has
a Sacred
Foundry. Nobody's complaining about they have a Stirring Wildwood because I'm the only one that drafts that card and puts it in my deck.
I think it's more that their opponents have access to a thing that they never could have possibly opened or like been passed, right? Like,
sure.
I just never could have gotten a land that powerful for my deck. Which I've wondered sometimes if like you could do a cycle of shocks plus all these other things and still get all those other lands in there and just get rid of that impact of like people feeling bad that their opponent gets to play Stomping Ground or Sacred Foundry and they're stuck with their Temple of Deceit or whatever. Which brings me to one other point about lands that I've been feeling recently. I'm historically a big fan of playing with the Ravnica Bounce lands.
Yes.
They're not appropriate for the Bun Magic Cube, but that doesn't mean I don't like them. I put them all in the Neoclassical Cube, and I've really enjoyed them there. This last draft of your cube, I really hated my Dimir Aqueduct so much in my blue-black deck. It did nothing but screw me over. And I realized after the draft that it should have just been Temple of Deceit, because my deck had a ton of 2-drops, and so I wanted to play a tap land on turn 1 if I could, and not being able to play that stupid bounce land on turn 1 bit me so many times, and the card advantage that I gained from, you know, having it later helped me in one game where I mulled to 5 and was able to still win because one of my lands was a bounce land. But in every other game, it's like, I had plenty of cards. I was like ninjutsu card draw deck, so I didn't care about the extra card at all.
Right.
All
yeah.
I cared about was not being able to play my stupid dual land on turn 1. And I was really mad at it by the end of the draft. So
can I say, as a designer, I could say that's a success. Because,
oh, yeah. This is not a criticism of you at all. This is me noting that it's a very different reaction than I've had to playing with these cards historically. I usually like these lands quite a lot.
And, like, I love playing Dimir Aqueduct, like, in my blue-white deck that's splashing black in this cube specifically.
Right, sure.
And so I think that's cool that, you know, there are multiple iterations of cards that want a blue-black fixing land, and some of those decks are going to want the bounce land, some of them are going to prefer the temple, and that's just more depth for
spiky players to make those decisions. I prefer really the water grave that doesn't land. Exist. And yeah. which I mean, this is not, talk about the regular cube critically corner, but I do think that is actually maybe a subtle factor that is contributing substantially to the kinds of decks you can draft. Like, I drafted this blue-black ninjutsu deck. Everyone was like, I've never seen this before. It'd be cool to see if it works. And I think a big reason you've never seen it before is that I don't get any untapped dual lands. Mm-hmm. And I said I have a lot of 2-drops. I did, but my best starts were any 1-drop creature into 2-drop ninja. And I just couldn't do that on my mana base almost ever.
Sounds like a skill issue.
I'm taking that comment in stride. Gracefully. Let's close off here with a couple of fun ones that are maybe unrelated to Magic. AI Brady wants to know, what's the best meal you've ever had in your life?
This is a really difficult question. The first thing that jumps to my mind is the first time I had soup dumplings.
Do you remember, like, where it was?
Yes, it was a restaurant in Atlanta, but then we actually had soup dumplings in Taiwan when we were on a trip there together, and that was a really great meal. And then the next time I had soup dumplings... Yeah, I'm just going to stick with soup dumplings. I mean, I love a big, like, Chinese-style meal where you have the big Lazy Susan and somebody is, you know, the menu daddy or menu mommy and orders a bunch of food. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I'm not going to look at the menu. Everything's going to come. And then you just spin around the Lazy Susan and get all kinds of soups and braises and dumplings and leek pies and more dumplings. Yeah.
I feel like the right answer to this question is supposed to be...
like, oh, my wedding meal or
right,
anniversary.
Right, like, oh, the first time...
Well, hey, I don't have any risk of offending anybody there.
I mean, no, you could have been, like, you know, an important meal with a friend or with your family or something. But, like, I do remember, like, the meal that I had when Hillary first said she loved me, right? Like, that should be my answer.
She doesn't listen to the podcast, does she?
I mean, this is no reflection on my love for my wife at all. But if I'm honest, my father-in-law used to be very into going to nice restaurants. He was a big...
Okay.
He and I both hate the word foodie. He was a passionate patron...
A food enthusiast.
A passionate patron of the food arts. And I have been lucky to go to a lot of very, very nice, very expensive restaurants with him and my wife. And I'll be honest. The first time you go to a really nice restaurant... Like, I do remember the very first time I ever went to, like, a nice, nice restaurant. It was Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore back when it was open in college at some point. And that was the first time I was like, I'm going to pay maybe a third digit for a meal. Like, that's preposterous. Like, that's absolutely obscene, especially when you're a college student.
Also, remember that food has doubled in price in the last year and a half.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Also, when you're a college kid, that is like, it's just impossible to imagine spending that amount of money on something that you will not still have at the end of the evening. I think the first time you have a really good meal, it's hard to... Or the first time you have a meal at a, like, really, really nice restaurant... That experience is kind of hard to recapture. I feel like a lot of people end up chasing that dragon for a long time because once you've had your, like, taste recalibrated, then you go to beautiful, amazing restaurants, and you're like, okay, yeah, it's more of that great food that I know and love, but you never kind of get that first experience of like, I didn't know food could actually be this good, right? And to be honest, at the end of Warby Kitchen's no longer open, by the time it closed, I was like, that place is overrated. It's not actually that good. But the first time I went there, first of all, I do think it was better in the early days, mm-hmm. but also the much bigger effect there was just that I had never been to a really nice restaurant. All by means of saying, I've been to a lot of really nice restaurants, and a lot of them, frankly, I'm like, yeah, that's good, but it's not like knocking my socks off, right? Like, I've been to like 11 Madison Park. It was good. It was great even, but I still like don't remember that meal in great detail. In Little Washington is an amazing restaurant in the like Virginia countryside that I ate at the chef's table at in the kitchen, where you get to like watch them cook and they bring things over to you, like, you know, they're right off the stove and like make things special. That was a great meal, but again, like the food was eh.
Wow, sick brags.
The food wasn't eh. No, I know this is like people are probably rolling their eyes out of their head. This is like the cringiest thing to possibly say, but it's my honest experience. All by means of saying though, I got to go to Per Se, Thomas Keller's restaurant in New York, after having been to many other beautiful restaurants, and honestly, kind of. I went the same weekend I went to 11 Madison Park, and the night before we were at 11 Madison Park, and I was like, that meal was good, but it wasn't great. If I was paying for it, I would not have been at all happy to have paid that amount of money for that amount of food. It would have felt like it wasn't really worth it.
And then ironically, it actually takes like twice as much labor, so you really should be paying so much more for these meals.
That's the thing people I think maybe don't know about these really fancy restaurants, is they think it's like expensive the same way that like a Prada handbag is expensive, where they've like marketed it to rich people and convinced them it's a great thing, but it's actually just not that great.
No, you're paying not for a logo, you're paying for tremendous labor and attention to detail.
Yeah, one of the best meals I've ever had, it's up there, it was at a restaurant called Mini Bar in DC. It's one of Jose Andres' many restaurants in DC. I believe it is his like fanciest, most experimental, most kind of like high-end fancy one. It's just two tables in the kitchen. Like, the restaurant is 85% kitchen, and there's like two long tables there. So you can have like two parties at each seating, and there's like two seatings a night or something, right? And when you're in that restaurant, you like start looking around. You're like, all right, well, there's 10 people at our like long skinny table, there's 8 people at that long skinny table, and there's 24 people in here cooking for us, right? Like the amount of people and the amount of hands that touch every dish of this like, you know, 12 course meal, you realize that like the food is crazy expensive, and they are, for the most part, like sensations like Alini are maybe excluded, they're not making a killing off of it, right? They're like doing it because they love what they're doing. Anyway, all by means of saying, this is maybe, I'm just trying to make this sound like a little more defensible of a bougie thing to enjoy, because it is. It's bougie and cringy. But went to 11 Madison Park and was like, that was good. But I also had the distinct feeling, and I talked to Hillary about this. I was like, I wonder if I am like losing my love for these fancy restaurants. And just maybe I lost my ability to appreciate it because I've had so many great meals, which is a huge brag and also sad. Like, it's a huge bummer if that was the case. And the next night we went to Per Se, and that was the best meal I've ever had in my entire life. And I feel like I had that experience again that I had when I was in college at Woodbury Kitchen, where I was like, every single thing that came out was incredible and blew me away. And I didn't know I could still feel that way. So I guess my answer is probably Per Se.
And now your jadedness is ratcheted up one more level. So the next meal you have to have that gives you that feeling has to be so much better. Well, I'm gonna give the other horrible humble brag here and say, I know I cooked myself a meal like a month or two ago, and I just had this feeling, I think this is the best meal I've ever eaten that I've just cooked for myself, and I don't even remember what it was. It was probably tacos or pasta or ramen, maybe ramen.
Oh yeah, one last meal came to mind, which is also in DC, this restaurant called Metier. It's like, you go to a super fancy restaurant, you know, and it's like expensive and fancy and bougie and everything like that. This restaurant is in the basement of an already extremely fancy restaurant for people that are too fancy for the extremely fancy restaurant upstairs.
Oh, yeah. I know all about that.
Like, you walk in and you're like, oh, it's a fancy place. And they're like, please ignore this peasantry. Come on downstairs to the fancy restaurant. This one is memorable. I mean, the food was fantastic. This one was memorable because both Hillary and my father-in-law felt ill. And so I ate most of their food of all like 12 courses as well, and just absolutely gorged myself on this incredible meal. So yeah, Metier as well. Long answer to your question.
Okay, well, that was something.
Long answer to your question, AI Brady. Long answer that maybe will have alienated me from our listeners. I'm sorry. I didn't pay for it. It's not my fault. I'm just eating food. I love it.
Well, Dynaticus asked, what new recipe or food has been your favorite to make or to eat this year? Since we're on the subject, is it per se? You just go get per se every couple weeks?
Okay, shut up. I feel like that's a great you question. Where do you want to go with that?
Well, what I'm struggling with is I'm trying to figure out the timeline of, like, when did I start cooking stuff? I just made a loaf of sourdough, which turned out okay, but I think I started that 2 years ago, maybe. I think, okay, this is maybe one of, this might have actually been the meal that I ate that I was like, wow, this is the best thing I've ever cooked. And it's really simple. It's a pork miso soup. This is a Japanese dish. You thinly slice some pork belly or other sort of fatty pork, fry it up, some carrots and radish and burdock, a couple other vegetables, and don't even make like a fancy Japanese stock first. I think you just throw in some kombu and then season it with miso, serve that with a bowl of rice, and it's so good. Similarly, like the first time I made it, I was like, this is incredible. I'm going to make this again tomorrow night. And it was just never as good.
You never get it back.
This is also the dish that, if you've seen the show Midnight Diner, this is the dish that he has, the one dish he has on his menu, which is sweet.
That's a fun reason to make it. I have not been doing as much cooking, honestly, since the pandemic began, which is like 3 years ago at this point. But being at home for every meal. Like, I used to come home from work every day and cook dinner basically every night and be excited to do it. It was how I, like, unwinded from work. But now also being home for breakfast and lunch, I'm just, like, tired of dishes and tired of kitchen and have lost a lot of my zest for home cooking, unfortunately. I do still do it quite a bit. I don't know what my favorite thing I've cooked this year is, but I have been making a lot of carbonara pasta, which I've been...
I had no idea.
I've not had, what? You've had no idea of making carbonara pasta?
Yeah.
Oh, I do it all the time. It's one of my go-tos.
I feel like we see each other all the time, and yet you have this whole secret carbonara habit I know nothing about.
Yeah, it's really good. I've gotten really good at it, and it's fast, and I do it for lunch a lot of times. Obviously, I've been cooking that for longer than just this year. It's not like a new recipe, but I have made that more times this year than almost anything else. Probably that and fried rice have been up there.
Fried rice is a good
one. Because we'll
order
Indian food from our favorite Indian restaurant, and they always give you way too much rice, and then I'll save it in the refrigerator. And then you make fried rice out of that dry refrigerator rice, which is the best fried rice. That's the other thing I made a lot for myself this year.
Fried rice with basmati rice. I can't criticize not wasting food, so keep up the good
work.
It's
fusion, Anthony. It's fusion. I feel like I have to re-earn my not a food snob
by
cred.
Making fried rice.
Look, I also love breakfast cereal and like fried chicken, okay? I'm just like you, I swear to God. All right, let's end things off here on a festive seasonal question. This is from Non-Striped Zebra. Eggnog, is it gross? What about with rum?
Eggnog is absolutely not gross. It's delicious. I had some just the other night.
I want to end on this question because I have never had eggnog.
Oh.
But I think this is the year I'm going to have eggnog.
Is there some sort of eggnog event that's happening?
No, I just... first of all, I think it's got a terrible name. Whoever branded eggnog did an awful job and they should feel bad about themselves. I don't understand how I'm supposed to hear about a drink called eggnog and want to consume it, right? I feel like this is a thing where you hear about some like ridiculous food item in another culture that's got some like disgusting name, and with the benefit of the outside perspective, you're like, well, that's plainly gross. That's how I feel about eggnog. Like, how can we ever look at that name and be like, sounds good?
I think that context matters here. I feel like if we were in the UK, we would just be like, yeah, that's a normal name for a food.
Well, yeah, their foods are gross. the bar is way lower over there.
Well, no, I think the names for a lot of their foods are gross. Although I do appreciate, what podcast was this? Somebody was
talking
about
bangers and mash and blood sausage and spotted dick.
That's all of them. someone was talking about pudding in the US and like, yeah, it's confusing. The pudding here is just goo.
I listened to that podcast too. I can't remember which one it was, but... Oh, it was Big Soft Titty with Libby Watson. It was Libby Watson on Big Soft Titty. Do I have to bleep the name of that podcast when I say it?
Probably.
Otherwise, do I have to say that we swore in this episode if I don't
you
bleep the name
swear.
Of the podcast?
You just said a thing.
Yeah, she was like, yeah, pudding in America is sweet goo. And then she was like, actually, it's pretty good. I actually don't mind it. Anyway, I think I'm going to try eggnog for the first time this year.
But is there like a schedule? Do you have a plan? You got to have a plan.
I'm going to be at a party. Someone's going to offer me eggnog and I'm going to accept it. That's my plan.
Okay. Maybe I'll make some eggnog. I've never done it before.
And if you make it, I'll definitely try it.
Okay. Is rum the right choice? I feel like brandy is the right choice.
My question to you is going to be, my understanding was that eggnog is traditionally always alcoholic. And to have it non-alcoholic is like, I guess you can make it non-alcoholic.
That's just like raw ice cream at that point.
Raw ice cream?
Yeah. It's just eggs and milk.
I have no idea what the ingredients of eggnog are. So
it's egg, and I'm gonna let you figure out what the other ingredient is.
Nog.
You got it.
I don't know what nog is. You're saying nog is milk?
Eggs, sugar, cream, milk, nutmeg, vanilla extract.
Is it whole eggs or just egg yolks?
Just egg yolks, according to this recipe, which is probably AI generated because the internet's a disaster.
Well, it's because you make ice cream with egg, you use just egg yolks. So that
I guess
makes,
so. I've never made ice cream either.
That I have made. I mean, if it's just melted ice cream, sign me up. I'm into that for
sure.
Yeah,
it's basically what it is.
I just thought it was like always alcohol. I think that's the other thing. That's the other reason I was like, I've never tried it, is that I'm not a drinker, really. And so I don't think, ooh, an alcoholic drink, I want to have that. And I've always kind of looked at eggnog
and you're
like,
ooh, an alcoholic drink. That also sounds gross.
Well, but it's also like, but it's like, why would I go out of my way to have like a virgin margarita, which is kind of what I looked at eggnog as, where it's like, if I'm not having alcoholic eggnog.
Am I talking to the same person that you are? Does that make any sense? I have known you to down an entire thing of margarita mix.
You've known me to tell you I did that. You've never seen me do it. It was back in high school, and I just discovered that it was middle school, high school era.
It's just intense juice.
I just called it super lemonade. I was like, this is just like lemonade, but so much better. Anyway, as an adult.
And now you go to Per Se and enjoy their...
I'm not a food snob. I drink margarita mix straight up and call it super lemonade.
Super lemonade.
No, my point is just that as an adult, I don't seek out like mocktails.
So what we should call eggnog is like super ice cream juice.
Yeah, I mean that's a much better name. Way more interesting. I'm way more interested in that. Anyway, this is the year. I'm gonna give it a try. In your honor, non-striped zebra.
So another thing that's cool about eggnog is you put enough booze in it, it's basically shelf stable and you can even age it. It just gets safer over time.
What does aged eggnog taste like?
I have no idea. Do you want to find out?
I'm going to start with the fresh stuff.
I feel like this always comes up on cooking issues where they're like, yep, this guy who has four batches of eggnog that he's been aging for 20 years tastes a little bit of each one, and we get some tasting notes.
I mean, that sounds good. I would definitely try that.
Old?
If I'm in the basement of...
Super ice cream juice.
If I'm in the basement of the guy that has been aging four different batches of eggnog for varying amounts of time, you know I'm trying everything I'm presented
definitely,
with, for
definitely.
Sure, 100%. I saw a YouTube video was recommended to me. I watch a lot of weird YouTube videos about like engineering and like other DIY nonsense.
New branches of the military, but for smiles.
Yep. I got recommended a video that was about this guy in like the Midwest who discovered that his garage had a huge cistern under it, like for capturing rainwater before there was like central water because it was an old house. So his garage basically had like a huge room that was just watertight under the garage that was like, you know, 8-foot tall ceilings and just like a giant, essentially a basement, but it was accessible through like a
trap door
and a like ladder. And with this cistern, he decided he would start his own fish farm for himself. So he like breeds fish in his cistern in like 2 or 2.5 feet of water that thrive in like cold, dark environments and then like eats them. I thought of you. I thought, like, if Anthony had a cistern, this is some shit he would do.
Grow fish?
Just something food-related. It's like a little farm, you know. He has, like, sturgeon down there. Apparently, like, farm-raising sturgeon is very hard.
It is, yeah.
They like cool, fresh water and the dark. And so people have contacted him being like, how do you make sturgeon be happy?
How legal is that?
That they don't touch on in the video, and it made me question... I mean, it's the kind of thing you probably wouldn't have a law against explicitly.
No, I think there's...
If you didn't think about it.
It's definitely very illegal to harvest wild sturgeon basically anywhere, but I think all the sturgeon in North America are already extinct, so maybe it doesn't apply.
I don't know where he got his sturgeon. If it's in his basement already, how do you know how he got it? I mean, like, that's fine, right?
I just found him in there.
Yeah. I couldn't possibly have done a crime, officer. It was cool to have, like, a secret... dark giant aquarium.
Yeah,
it also helped me recontextualize the like size of things, because they were saying that like if you are buying a big tank for home consumer use for aquaculture, a big tank is like 300 gallons or 400 gallons, and this cistern was like 6,000 gallons. Like the how much bigger it was than like a normal tank was impressive.
Sorry, I'm really stuck on a big tank for home aquaculture?
Yeah.
Is this what people that live in outside of cities do? Just
some people
like,
live in cities do gonna... that.
Huh.
You can have any hobby you want.
I've heard of like urban beekeeping.
Yeah, this is like that, but for water.
But for water.
This is wet urban beekeeping.
Come to my basement, check out my wet bees.
If this podcast was slightly less focused, I would call it wet urban beekeeping, but that does not actually make any sense for the context of this show, which is now over. So thank you for tuning in to this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. We're coming up to the end of the year, so be on the lookout for our end of the year wrap-up article, and we do have our episode coming up where we're going to be talking about all of our highs and lows and hits and misses from the past year in cube design, which is always a favorite of people. So make sure you're subscribed to the feed or subscribed here to the YouTube channel to make sure you catch that. And if you're watching on YouTube, where I've been posting more regularly and we finally crossed some threshold where more people see our stuff with the algorithm or whatever, if you're listening on YouTube, consider getting a podcast app where you won't hear ads, and also our relationship to you will not be governed by a private company. Independent media for life. Anyway, all of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. The show is produced by Anthony and I thinking really hard about magic cards and your thoughtful questions, and then speaking into microphones about it.
And eggnog. I think we thought a lot about eggnog.